want to thank all of you for being here this morning. It really is good to see you. I'll have to admit, singing that song this morning, that's the first time in my life I've had a hard time getting through that song. My eyes welled up with tears. I mentioned earlier, it seems like it's been more than 3 days it's been, but I've enjoyed it. I really have. Has it been about 20 years? About 20 years, sitting around their dining room table singing, "Our God, He is Alive." And what a joy to be able to do that now, and to have Ethan, their son, leading that song, and he was just a little baby at the time. That's wonderful. Jesus told the parable of the kingdom of heaven is like the seed, the mustard seed, you plant it, and you don't know what's going to happen. But then there's a tree that the birds come and dwell in. It's just a great blessing. So you've got a lot to be thankful for, to have the Tweedies here as members of the body of Christ. It's just a real pleasure. Well, I need to stop talking about that, because I won't get through the lesson. Let's see. Need to press the right button, don't I? God's purpose for the parents. Let me ask you, parents, what do you want for your children? What do you want for your children? What's your goal for them? I remember years ago when Joshua, our firstborn son, he knew what day the garbage pickup was. And the route was such that the truck was fairly full in the back. So when it got to the front of our house, the driver would get out, load the garbage, and then he'd work the hydraulics to push the garbage up. And our son thought that was the most magnificent thing. He was just thoroughly fascinated with that machinery working like that. So that at a young age, our son, firstborn son, wanted to be a garbage man. And I thought, well, here's a teachable moment. There's nothing wrong with being a garbage man. That can be an honorable profession. And so I thought, I'll encourage him. If that's what you want to do, that's fine. But you make sure you're the best one, that you always do what's right. Because I could honestly say to him, I'd rather you be a garbage man and be faithful in your work and go to heaven than to be the richest man on earth with a well-respected profession and lose your soul. Isn't that right? So what do you want for your children? Hopefully you would answer, ultimately, for that child to be with God in eternity. In other words, your children will be saved. If that goal is not reached, if you don't make it to heaven, if your children don't make it to heaven, then all is lost. Jesus said there in Matthew 16:26, where he raises the question, what is a man profited if he gains the whole world but loses his soul? What is the answer to that question? If you could gain the whole world, just pile up all the riches that the world has to offer, and then say, that's mine. If you could gain all of that, but in the end, you lose your soul, what have you gained? Absolutely nothing. And whether it's the world's riches, or whether it's fame, whether it's popularity, whatever it might be, nothing is worth you losing your soul. Nothing at all. So when we talk about our responsibility as parents, what do we hope to accomplish? Well, certainly we want our children to do well in life, but not at the expense of losing their soul. So as parents, we want to so teach our children and raise them so that heaven can be their ultimate destination. God told the children of Israel of old in Deuteronomy 6 and verse 7 that they were to teach their children diligently. He said, you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. Would you say that diligence describes what you do with your children in teaching them the ways of the Lord? That's what God told the people of Israel, to teach them diligently. And we know that what they had, of course, that was the will of God. It was God preparing a people for the eventual coming of Christ. But what they were doing was of extreme importance, and God expected those parents to teach those children diligently. Again, I ask the question, does that characterize you? We have now the fulfillment of what God had planned through the people of Israel. We have the Christ. He has come into the world. All of His will has been revealed to us in His Word. He tells us exactly what we need to know. We know the story from the beginning. Here's the Old Testament. Here's the New Testament. Do you teach that diligently to your children? If you want them to be able to go to heaven, that is something you must do. It's the Word of God that will give life to a person. Do we want our children to be obedient to God? When we talk about being obedient to God, when should you do what God says? If God said do something, then when should you do it? Right away. In other words, if we find out that God says do something and we say, oh, that's good, I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do it next week. In this series of lessons, we've talked about being good husbands and good wives. Well, if I find out here's what God wants me to be as a husband or a wife, when should I start doing that? Do it right away. I can't think of anything that God tells us to do that we can tell God, I'll start tomorrow. How about today? Does God expect us that when He tells us to do something, that we do it all the way? Is it okay to just halfway obey God? Is it okay just to do a portion of what He says? Should we not do all of it? And with what kind of attitude does God want us to have when we obey Him? Would He be satisfied with us going through the motions of worship and not have our heart in it? Is that acceptable to God? You can't read the Old Testament and come away with that conclusion. Is it okay that if we do something in obedience to the will of God that we gripe and complain about that? No way. Some of you, since you homeschool, are familiar with some of the material put out by the Pearls, and some of it's very good. I believe they're the ones that came up with this short version of what we're talking about, that you teach your children to obey right away, all the way, and with a happy heart. That's good. Now, there has to be a lot of training to do with doing something with a happy heart. You know, how do you do something with the right kind of attitude? And a good portion of the children learning that's going to come from you as the parent. Of course, all that the child learns, not only being taught what God says, but actually seeing that put to practice, that's your responsibility as the parent. So what do the children see in regard to your response to the will of God? Are you the kind of person that you do what God says and you do it right away? You don't put it off. And you are determined to do all that God says, not just portions of, not just what is convenient for you, but you're willing to do whatever God says, even when it's inconvenient, and the kind of attitude that you have when you do what's right. Do your children see you complain about doing the will of God? Do you leave the impression that serving God is a hardship, that there's really some other better things to do? Please don't teach that to your children. But I think it's a very good point that others have made, that you should learn how to do the will of God right away, all the way, and with a happy heart. That you want your children to do that. And we should train them to that end. If I want my child to be like this, in other words, to be an obedient child, that they do it immediately, do it with the right kind of attitude, if that's the kind of person I want them to be tomorrow, when should I start training them for tomorrow? And that's today, isn't it? I can't wait till tomorrow. Of course, the problem with waiting till tomorrow is, when does tomorrow come? You see, when tomorrow gets here, that's today. And tomorrow's the next day. Tomorrow doesn't come, does it? And when we talked earlier in one of the lessons about how short life is, that those of us who are older will tell every one of you who are younger, don't waste the time now, because these days will be gone. It still chokes me up to think and to look at the pictures of us holding our babies. Now we're holding grandchildren. And that was just yesterday that we were holding our children. The time will get away from you. The time will go by much faster than you think. Please do not fall into the trap of thinking, well, my children are young, they're just one or two, or they're five or six or ten, and we've got plenty of time. I know that when you are young, 18 years seems like a long time away. 18 years is not very long at all. It will go by in a hurry. So I'm begging you. I know what I'm talking about. If you're a parent and you've got those little ones at home, please be diligent in your teaching them of the Word of God and be setting the right example for that. All right. What if the child refuses to obey? You've done the best that you can in teaching the child. Here are the expectations. Here are things that we do. Here are things that we do not do. What do you do when the child is rebellious in regard to that? The child just makes it clear they're not going to do that. What do you do? Has God given us some instructions on that? And indeed He has. What was done to the what instructions did God give the people of Israel of old when they had a rebellious son? Deuteronomy chapter 21. Deuteronomy 21 and verse 18. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out of the elders of his city to the gate of this city. And they shall say to the elders of his city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He's a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. That was God's instruction to the people of Israel. That law is not in effect today. But that tells us something about, well, how seriously did God take a rebellious son? If you were rebellious, a drunkard, a glutton, they took you out and stoned you to death. That says to me, that's a serious matter. Doesn't it to you? Now, like I said, we don't have that today. But that simply lets us know, here's what God thought of rebellion among the children. We have a number of verses that I've just trying to shorten this for time's sake, that tell us something that our society today says, you can't do that. Again, how many times does God have to tell us something to get a point across? And we have these passages in the book of Proverbs that tell us something about corporal punishment, that there is a place for it. Now, I know our world, our society today says, you ought not to abuse a child. I would agree wholeheartedly with that. Remember, we talked yesterday about the fact, who gave us the family? God did. Who gave the instructions for family life? God did. Does God know what He's talking about? Yes. Does God know how to bring about joy in the family? Without question. Of course He does. And when it comes to rebellion, when it comes to conduct that is not right, when there's someone who is failing to do what they ought to do and they're rebellious in their spirit, does God tell the parent, here's what you do? Yes. And that tells me that a person can do this and not be guilty of abuse. Abuse is something you will do when you are angry and you're striking back at someone in anger. What God is telling the parent to do here is something where you are very controlled, and the punishment is going to meet the whatever the wrongdoing was. It's determined to get the child's attention and to understand their consequences. So we find in Proverbs 13 and verse 24, it's an interesting passage. We used to have this on the board at the county fair. We had a booth at the county fair down in Delaware County. And it was interesting. I had this on the board, and people were to determine whether that was in Scripture or not. Did the Bible say this? And we had spare the rod, spoil the child. And more people said, yes, that's in the Bible. I said, no, that's not in the Bible. We turned to the passage. And he says in Proverbs 13:24 that if you spare the rod, you hate your child. And we'd read that and people would say, oh, you're just being nitpicky with words. No. Is there a difference between spoiling a child and hating your child? Well, sure there is. Our society says if you spare the rod, you spoil the child. God says if you don't discipline, you hate your child. In other words, you're not giving them guidance. You're not letting them know that there are serious consequences to wrongdoing. That's a hateful thing, to bring a child into the world thinking that you can rebel against the rules, you can rebel against what is expected of you, and that's okay. That's a terrible message to give to your child. God says you spare the rod and you hate your child. In Proverbs 22:15, it's referred to as the rod of correction. In Proverbs 23:13, he says you can, he uses the word beat there, and that's probably not a good word because people think of abuse. But again, it's the use of the rod. It's the use of some device that, as someone said, you apply the board of education to the seat of learning. I think that's pretty good. It says the child won't die. That lets us know that the punishment that you're giving is not abusive and to do harm to the child where there's the physical harm to the point of creating a health problem. He says you can administer this and the child won't die. In Proverbs 23:14, that you end up delivering his soul from hell. Proverbs 29:15, the rod gives wisdom. You're learning a very valuable lesson here. The point is that a child must learn that there are consequences to bad behavior. We have to learn that. Isn't that what the Bible warns each one of us about? That there will be a judgment day. And God will hold each of us accountable for what we've done in this life, whether good or evil. Are there not consequences to our behavior? Do I need to learn that? I have to. If I go through this life thinking, there's no consequences to what I do. I just do whatever. That's okay. That's not the right message to learn. There are consequences to what we do. And so at a very early age, we need to be teaching our children. There are consequences to bad behavior. I've mentioned that I do work at the local prison. And I have asked the men in the various classes, before you committed whatever crime you did you stop to think about what would happen if you got caught in your wrongdoing? Many of them gave no thought to that at all. Many of them did not think about there were consequences. Many of them said, yeah, I thought about it, but I didn't care. They didn't care about the consequence, whatever happened. They were so filled with rage. They were so vindictive. They wanted to strike back. And they didn't care. Well, don't you think as a parent, I'd want to teach my children that there are consequences and you need to care about what you do? Now here's a guy sitting in prison for 10, 20 years. Well, that's not a pleasant thing. Don't you think as a parent, I wouldn't want my child to be in that circumstance. How can I get them to the point of realizing if you do this, you're going to end up in prison. If you do this, you're going to destroy your family. If you do this, you're going to lose your soul. We've got to teach that lesson because there are consequences to our attitudes. There are consequences to our behavior. And it's the parent's responsibility to teach that to the child. Ephesians chapter 6, this is a familiar passage, and you know we would turn to this if we're going to be studying what God says about the parent. In Ephesians 6 and verse 4, God says, "And you, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord." Let's just make a real important note here. Who does God give the primary responsibility to in raising the children? The fathers. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Again, in a prison class where maybe I've got 50 guys, 60 guys. How many of you are parents? You've got children. Just about every hand will go up. How many of you are married? Not as many hands go up. I've studied with men, just as you were mentioned in the opening remarks. I've studied with men who have 7 or 8 children, all by different women. 7 or 8 children. 7 or 8 mothers. Not married to any of them. So here's a man who's brought all these children to the world, and who's taking care of them? Well, he's not. He's in prison. And so try to drive home the point. If you bring a child into the world, you are responsible for raising that child. Now, again, when we talked about the husband and wife, that they work together, God's given that primary responsibility to the man. But the wife is the helpmeet. She's the helper. She helps him carry out this responsibility. I'm afraid that what we've done, we've just handed all that responsibility over to the mother. Say, here, you take care of it. I'm busy with other things. God says, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. That's the man's responsibility, with the wife helping. Let's just make sure we appreciate this point. God says there's a judgment day coming, and He's going to judge us in keeping with what we've done in view of the responsibilities He's given to us. So, if you are a father, is God going to hold you accountable for how you have raised your children? Indeed, He is. Notice also that the father can have an effect upon the children. He says, don't provoke your child to wrath. In other words, there's something that I might do as a parent, as a father, that instead of training the child in the way he should go, I end up provoking that child to wrath. So, well, how in the world would I do that? I don't want to do that. How would I do that? What does that look like? Notice that that's in contrast to bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. So don't provoke your children to wrath. Now in Colossians 3:21, we've got the same thought. Here he says, fathers, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged. It's interesting that in these two verses, we've got two possibilities of a direction a child may go when the father fails to do what he ought to do. Either they're filled with wrath, there's a rebellious spirit, or they become discouraged and give up. Those are the two possibilities that a child may end up doing, kind of attitude, if the father is not doing what he ought to do. Again, it leads them to rebellion, be filled with anger, or it leads them to be discouraged and just to give up. So, as fathers, you and I need to be praying, please give me the wisdom to raise my child that they not become rebellious, and they not become angry, and they not become discouraged and just give up and say, what's the use? I have met both kinds of people, haven't you? The rebellious kind of person and the person who just doesn't care. They say, well, why should I even try? They just give up. They've got a broken spirit. And that can come from a father not doing what he ought to do. How might a parent provoke the child? Here God says, don't do this. Well, what does it look like? How can I know whether or not I'm leading in a way that I don't provoke the child? I believe you'll find this to be an interesting list of thoughts of how a parent might provoke the child to wrath, to anger, or to discouragement. There can be a lack of marital harmony. Now, these next few verses we're going to be looking at, you may be surprised as I was when studying this. I mentioned it in a previous lesson how you can study how to deal with people And it doesn't involve great intellect. It just involves a knowledge of God's Word. That here's a principle that God sets forth. And there'd be so many times that I could apply that principle over here in this situation, but fail to see how it applies to me. Fail to see how this principle is applicable in any number of different situations. And when you get your mind open to the fact that here God is telling us exactly how to think and what to do, and the principle that's involved in this one situation can be equally applied to another situation. For example, in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 15, he says, looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. Now, in that particular context, he's encouraging Christians, you know, to be faithful. But I want us to appreciate the fact that what does bitterness do in your life? If you've got a bitter attitude, does that affect other Christians?
Yes.
Does it affect your outlook in life?
Yeah,
you're a bitter person. And that has a tremendous effect on other people. In the church? Can it have an effect in the family? I'm sure it can. Bitterness, no matter where, is bad. You can't have that kind of attitude without it affecting other people. And notice here he says, and by this many become defiled. As a result of the bad attitude I might have, I adversely affect other people. Is that true in the home? Of course it is. If you have a lack of marital harmony, in other words, if a child is brought up in a family where the husband and wife don't get along, where instead of resolving problems in a right way, they practice selfishness, and instead of being one and working together, they're at odds with one another, always arguing, always bickering about something, always complaining, always blame shifting. Well, I wouldn't have done that if you hadn't done that. Well, I wouldn't have done that if you hadn't. There's no end to that silliness and childish behavior. What will happen to a child who's brought up in that kind of environment? Sadly, they will probably imitate it. So that's what they've seen. They think, I guess this is how you handle problems. We'll talk more about that this afternoon. So if a husband and wife don't get along and solve problems as they ought to, that can provoke that child to wrath or to giving up. There's no good that comes from bitterness. What about having a child-centered home? Proverbs 29:15. The rod and rebuke give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. What is a child left to himself? That's a child that's running the house. We watched a series of videos. It was really good material. I forget the fellow's name who did it. But the whole series had to do with raising your children in a proper way, raising godly children. And he had a rather lengthy section dealing with how do you know if your children are running your family or not. And it was really good. Some of the things he said, he just described me. You're driving down the road and you're looking for some place to eat, and you and your wife would really like to go to this nice restaurant over here, and the kids are saying, we want to go to McDonald's, you know, and we want to get the Happy Meal, and they're just throwing a fit. And so the parents say, okay, we'll go to McDonald's. Now, who's running the family at that point? Do you know it's okay for parents to say, this is what we're going to do? And kind of hidden under that is, and you can learn to like it. And you won't be severely damaged if you don't get what you want. Do we need to teach our children that they can't always have their way? And they do have to yield to other people, especially the parents who God has given the responsibility to raise? Don't children need guidance? Don't children need a framework? Don't children need to understand that you can't always do what you want to do? And I I know when our children were raised, I wish somebody had told me this point, because I wanted my children to just be happy, you know, just enjoy being together. You know, you can enjoy life at another restaurant, not McDonald's. Now, that's possible. And you don't always have to go where the children want to go. You can go where you, as the adult, the parents, who say, this is what we're going to do. In other words, you want the children to be obedient. You want them to have the right kind of attitude. How do you want your children to act when they don't get to do what they want to do? Are you happy that they will throw a fit, pout, complain? Those are things you want to get rid of. You don't want a child acting like that. And as God says, a child left to himself without guidance, without a framework, without someone saying, here's what you must do, and then expecting the child to do that, that you'll end up with a child who, as God says, will bring shame to his mother. Whenever I'm walking into the prison or walking out, I'm also passing visitors going in. The wife visiting her husband or boyfriend. And then I see the mother and the grandmother who's going in to see the son in prison. And often wonder what's going through their minds. If it'd be me, I'd be thinking in terms of, I wonder where I went wrong. What could I have done better? Well, let's move on. There's other things. Modeling sinful anger. Proverbs 22, 24, and 25. Make no friendship with an angry man. You know why? God says, and you don't go with a furious man, lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul. In other words, he's a bad example. Well, what do you do if in the family, if you don't control your anger? You are bringing a child up in an atmosphere. They have no choice but to be in that. God says in this passage, you've got a choice. Don't make friends with an angry man, because you'll learn his way. So stay away from him. Here's a child brought into the family, and you are an angry person, and you display that in tone of voice, the words that you say, even physical abuse perhaps. What's going to happen to the child that's raised in that kind of environment? They'll become discouraged, give up, or maybe they will imitate the same kind of attitude. Modeling sinful anger. What about discipline and anger? James 1:19, so then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Why? Because the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. In other words, what good comes from when you lose control of your anger? No good comes from it. It does not produce the righteousness of God. And so, as I mentioned earlier, here's the occasion for the child having corporal punishment, a spanking. And God lets us know, you better not do that in anger. You had better not strike a child when you are angry about something. I know what that's like. Many of you would also. A child can do something and rebel. Why'd you do that? Well, the first thing I had to do is bring myself under control. And tell myself, you better not hit a child in anger. You don't do that. The wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Now, can you administer the rod in an attitude that says, I'm not angry myself? You have to learn that there are consequences to your bad behavior. There is going to be punishment involved in this, and it's going to hurt. But you must learn that. And you can calmly, in an attitude where there's no anger involved, where you're losing control, that you can punish that child. But if you fail to do that, then that won't produce anything good at all, as James 1:19 tells us. What about scolding, ridiculing, making fun of a child, mocking a child? And we're not talking about just good-natured joking around, things like that. We're talking about that you belittle the child in front of others. You're saying to the child, you can't ever do anything right. I've heard parents say, I'll be glad when you leave home. Ephesians 4:29, let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. Is that true as we deal with one another? Yeah. Is it true when I deal with people in the community that I need to watch the words that I say? Sure. Dealing with people in the church? Yeah. How about the parent towards the child? God says, let no corrupt words proceed out of your mouth. That's with everybody, all the time. Maybe we need to remind ourselves, because I know this comes up frequently. God will hold us accountable for the words that we say. Jesus said, by their fruits you shall know them. For every idle word men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. Jesus says, for by your words you will be condemned, and by your words you will be justified. If you have a problem with bad language, you must stop that. God will hold you accountable for bad words. And God tells us the reason for that is that bad words come out of a bad heart. Now, you can say that you're good, like James records people who were religious, but they didn't control their tongue. He says their religion's a waste of time. Because when bad words come out, that says there's the condition of my heart. It's a bad heart. I've got to change the heart. When I change my heart, that will change how I speak. God says, let no corrupt words come out of your mouth. If corrupt words come out, have you got a problem? Will God hold you accountable in the day of judgment for words that you say? He says He will. And again, in view of what we're talking about here, what does that do to the child? The child who hears the abusive language, the child who hears the words that don't build up, the child who hears the words where they're made fun of and they're belittled in front of others, that accomplishes no good whatsoever. And that will either lead the child to rebellion or lead the child to be discouraged. Being inconsistent with discipline, Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 11 is interesting, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. There's a good verse to remember about just corporal punishment. In general, in society, when you have a society where the evildoer is not punished quickly, and I'm not talking about so quick that you don't have exercise judgment, where we're talking about you don't let years and years and years go by before you execute judgment. God says you execute judgment, it's to be done justly, but also to be done in a speedy time, because that is a deterrent to crime. He says because it's not done quickly, therefore, the sons of men, or the hearts of the sons of men, are given fully to do evil. It's kind of the attitude that I can do this and there won't be any consequences to it. I can do this and get away with it. No, you won't. But before God, and that's the lesson that must be learned. Well, our list continues. In Romans chapter 2, it's a rather lengthy passage. I just put two verses up here. It's the passage where God says, you teach people not to steal, talking to the Jews. He says, you teach people not to steal, do you steal? You who teach people not to commit adultery, do you do that? And so we get down to verses 23 and 24. You who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? And what happens as a result of people who teach one thing, don't do this, but they practice something else? God says, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as it is written. In other words, if you profess to be one thing and you are practicing something else, you're professing to be a Christian and you're living some other way, people end up blaspheming the name of God, he says, and that's because of you. Is there great harm done in church, community, and in the home when a profession is made of one thing and you're doing something else? That's called hypocrisy, isn't it? And it destroys people. It has an adverse effect upon others. Can you imagine doing that in your home? And our children will be the first to see hypocrisy. They'll see it. Don't think you're fooling them. They know when mom and dad's saying one thing and they're doing something else. That leads to a child becoming discouraged of being rebellious. Failure to admit wrong and to ask for forgiveness. Once again, in relationship to one another, we need to be forgiving. We need to ask for forgiveness. Jesus says, if you bring your gift to the altar and there, remember that your brother has something against you. In other words, you've sinned against him. Leave your gift there before the altar and go on your way. First, be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. In other words, if I'm guilty of something and I haven't taken care of that, what good does it do that I offer God something? God says, you better take care of the wrong in your life. Will that be true of my children? Have you, as parents, have you ever made a mistake with your children? Be honest now. Sure you have. What should you do? Go make it right. That can be hard to do, but I tell you what, it lifts burdens. When you know you're wrong, and you go to the person that you've wronged, whoever it might be, if it's your children, that you can honestly say to your children, I was wrong. Please forgive me. Those words lift burdens. Now, it's up to the individual to be forgiving, but at that point, you've done everything you can. And, of course, that's an excellent time to teach a child how to forgive. Don't ever hesitate to tell somebody that you've been wrong. Just a little side note here that I have found to be helpful. It may sound like I'm being nitpicky, but I'm not. Because there's something about words. Words have meanings, don't they? In a conversation we might have with people, that might go something like, I sure am sorry for what I did. And then the other person that we're talking to says, oh, that's okay. That's generally how people engage in this, I've done wrong, and I want to give you forgiveness. Those words don't exactly express what's actually going on. I'm sorry. There have been times that I've asked people, and using my kids, I'm just kind of joking around. They say, well, I'm sorry. And I say, well, are you bragging or complaining? Because I'm sorry really doesn't express what's really going on. Let me suggest that if you have sinned against another individual, if you've sinned against your child, then say this, I have sinned. Please forgive me. Now, what are they supposed to say? When people say, that's okay. Now, I know what they're meaning by that. They're saying, okay, everything's okay. But if you say, I'm wrong, I sinned, and then somebody says, that's okay, that's not okay. How do you deal with sin? If somebody says, I sinned, please forgive me, what do you think you ought to say? How about, I forgive you? There's going to be a huge burden lifted when you engage in that kind of a conversation. I sinned, please forgive me. I forgive you. Now, just try that and see if there's not a difference. I will guarantee you one thing. It's real easy to say, I'm sorry. I've heard people say, I'm sorry, okay? Not exactly a heartfelt sorry. and then to stick on the end of it, okay? That just really doesn't touch what the problem is. I sin. Please forgive me. I forgive you. All right, let's move on. Not listening to your child's side of the story or not taking him or her seriously. A child is 6 years old and they're crying. And maybe the problem isn't all that big to you, but to them it's huge. We need to learn to listen from their perspective. And this passage in Proverbs is interesting. The first one to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. In other words, there's always another side to the story. And before you jump to some conclusions, and sometimes we jump to the wrong conclusion, don't we? And what if we do that with our children? And we jump to the wrong conclusion with them? Do you think that could discourage them or lead them to rebellion? Yeah, sure can. We need to make that right. Chastening in front of others. This passage, well, this applies to as people sin against one another. Well, wait a minute. Here's a child who's done something wrong. What should you do? The principle that God sets forth, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you've gained your brother. The principle that's set forth there is, if I'm aware of a sin that you've committed, nobody else knows about it, what should I do? Come to you. Don't go to everybody else. You don't do it in front of everybody. You don't make it just a general proclamation that there's a problem here. Jesus says, you go to that individual. Well, wouldn't that be true with my children? If they've done something wrong, what should I do? Belittle them in front of everybody? No, you take the child alone and try to deal with that situation in a right way. And then unrealistic expectation, a point that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians 13 about spiritual gifts and the passing of the spiritual gifts and so forth. But the argument that he makes is based on a principle. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. That's true. There was the church in its infancy, and then the church matures. There's a need for the spiritual gifts and the infancy of the church, then it outgrows the need for that. The principle, though, is there that there are things that a child does, and there are things that you do as an adult. To expect a child to act like an adult is an unrealistic expectation. And so when a child is acting like a child, remember, it's a child. Now, if there's rebellion, if the child says, I'm not going to do that, they disobey, then that needs to be dealt with. But then children do childish things, don't they? So we close this by asking this important question, are you leading by example? The expectations you have of your children, do they see you living that kind of life? Does your children see what a difference Christ makes in your life? We need to remember here that when we talk about setting an example, we're not talking about you putting on a show. We're talking about you doing what's right because it's from your heart. That here's what you do because it's from your heart. And this is the kind of life you are going to live. And this is the kind of life you expect the child to live also. So how is your example? Are you leading them? What are they seeing in your life? Whoops. That's the next lesson. Now I need to stop at what time? Well, it's almost 11. Do you stop at?
Yeah.
About 11? Okay. All right, let me do this real quickly, and then we'll move to the next one after we break here. Let me ask the fathers first. What kind of man do you want your daughters to marry? How are your daughters going to know what kind of man to pick? They're going to get older, right? And if you've got daughters, are they going to eventually fall in love with somebody? How are they going to know what kind of man to look for? Who do you think is going to show them? How are they going to know what kind of man is the kind of man that this is the man that will bring true joy in the family? And that as we form a union now and make a new family with this individual, that we'll teach those the children of that union then the right way, that they all can go to heaven. But how do you know what kind of man your daughter's going to pick? The reason I ask that is because you, like me, we run into people who the daughter has picked a man to marry and he's the alcoholic. And you talk with her, she's very unhappy about the choice that she's made. And as you learn about her past, you learn that her dad was an alcoholic. And you say, if anyone would know what alcoholism does to a person, what it does to the family, that girl ought to know that. Why would she pick somebody who's going to continue that kind of lifestyle? That is, That doesn't make any sense. But you know why that happens so many times? That's what she's familiar with. Kind of got used to it, I guess. And whether it's the drunkard, whether it's the abusive person, it's the strangest thing that many times that daughter will marry a man who is just like her father. If you're going to be the right kind of father, then when your daughters watch you and she sees what kind of joy that brings in a family, to have a man like this who takes the lead spiritually, who sets the right kind of example, who controls his temper, she'll know that's the kind of man to look for. Of course, you're going to be teaching also, right? Mothers, what kind of woman will your son look to marry? You remember that old song they used to sing? I want a girl just like the girl that married dear old dad. Remember that song? I may be showing my age there. It wasn't exactly the top 40 when I was a teen, but I remember hearing that song. And I used to sing that song, and I often thought about, do I want a wife like my mom? And the answer would be yes. She was a godly woman. Not in looks and things like that, but just the spiritual strength, the love for truth, the desire to do what's right. Someone who will put God first. In my mind, that's the kind of woman I wanted. I got one. I've been blessed for it. But when we think about God's purpose for the parents, remember, we're talking about a temporary relationship that child will grow up in your home and then one day leave and start his or her own family that's to last for a lifetime. So what are we training them as far as what to look for in a mate? What kind of example are you setting? And that's extremely important. Your influence will continue on after you're gone. I beg of you to take these things seriously. You've got some precious souls. I'm so impressed with the young people here. They're handsome young men, beautiful young women. There's just a lot of potential here for good. But the lasting good will come as a result of what you're doing as a parent and raising that child in the proper way. Well, I need to stop. We'll take a few minutes break, however long. I'll let the men determine that. Thank you for listening so patiently. I'm going to like that now.
Come on. Okay. Not much of a remote, but at least it can be glad.